Hey guys, what's up? It is week 330, and I got a bunch of reviews for you. No update, but some questions and everything. So yeah, let's hop into this. The first one up is from MVD Rewind, and this is Ghoulies in 4K. That's right. This is their second 4K. The first one was Swamp Thing, which is pretty cool. Another MGM title here in Ghoulies. Ghoulies was produced by Charles Band from Empire Pictures at the time, later Full Moon. And this was kind of a take on their Gremlins. You know, a lot of people say a ripoff, whatever. I think it was in development before Gremlins was actually released. But then after it was released, they kind of just maybe toned it to more of a Gremlin-style film. This was made in Italy, I believe, or, you know, with some of the other Empire Picture flicks. 84, released in 85 for the most part. But yeah, this is spawned three sequels. It was directed by, how do you pronounce this, Luca Bertagovici. I always mispronounce his name. He was also an actor in a slew of things. And the biggest actor in Ghoulies is Jack Nance. So I've covered Ghoulies. I've covered the entire franchise with Dustin Mills on the show. Anybody who doesn't know me, Ghoulies 2 and 3 are a couple of my absolute favorites. They inspired me on my movies that I made, the cheap little killer creatures, little creatures flicks. Ghoulies 1, I always was a little hot and cold on. This is kind of like when Empire Pictures was first getting its footing and everything like that. So it was before like Prison and stuff like that. And even around the same time as Reanimator, right? Even before Reanimator and Troll and all that stuff. So yeah, anyways, this movie's actually shot fairly nice. And if you really register it in the 4K. Now, first and foremost, I got to say this. I find it really weird that when you look at like somebody like big companies like Warner Brothers in particular, not trying to badmouth Warner Brothers here, but they're 4Ks. I've not been impressed with them at all. Honestly, they look a lot like upscales. They just don't do anything for me. I thought the Goonies was drained of color from what I've seen. I just don't think that Warner Brothers 4Ks are great on their old catalog titles. Anybody correct me if I'm wrong, maybe tell me one that really kind of knocked your socks off. But I'm seeing a lot of these independent old school movies like Ghoulies and Swamp Thing. And then, of course, a lot of the stuff that Vinegar Syndrome is putting out on 4K. Just knocking the socks off the movies. Just doing so much better than what some of the big studios are doing, unfortunately, which is sad. But yeah, Ghoulies, like I said, this is kind of a cult classic. Jack Nance is in there. It opens up with a sacrifice. So the first Ghoulies has definitely a more of a satanic angle on it. The satanic angle would remain in all the sequels, but it would kind of be toned down a bit. This one I think has the heaviest. So there's a young, there's a kind of a necromancer kind of style guy, and he's going to want to sacrifice his baby. Reminds me of something like Devil Rides Out, right? The Hammer picture. The baby is kind of like it's ruined because the mother of the child puts a necklace on it. He's the father, the guy ready to sacrifice the baby, kind of run away. And we fast forward. We get the help of Jack Nance, of course. We fast forward to about 20 years or so. 25 years, and the son now has inherited this giant mansion. It's spooky, it's beautiful, like true, like kind of college kid fashion. He decides to throw a party there. His friends show up, shenanigans, absolutely ridiculous group of friends, a lot of weird humor. So this movie's tonally kind of strange, where it's like it seems serious at times and then really goofy. And unlike the other Ghoulies movies, like Ghoulies 2 and 3, where they kind of found their footing within the little creatures to focus on the Ghoulies, they kind of throw everything in the kitchen sink in here. Like I said, there's a necromancer, and then on top of that, they have kind of like some small people, dwarfs in here as well, and like some other kind of creatures. This is the only appearance by Ape Ghoulie. This is also one where they have like multiple Ghoulies of the same one, so there'll be like five or six of the alligator toad or like frog Ghoulies, and like a bunch of the rat and cat Ghoulies. So there's like multiples of all of them, which is kind of strange to me. I've always appreciated like 2 and 3 that they have one of each Ghoulie and everything like that. So he decides to do a seance. He's kind of possessed by the house to do such, and what he does is he raises the Ghoulies. But this also kind of puts the kind of catalyst for his father coming back and trying to take over and, you know, be evil and make the main sacrifice and get his unlimited power. The main baddie in here, the Sorcerer Father, reminds me a lot like Richard Lynch. Of course, not the quite of caliber of a Richard Lynch, but he's definitely got the Richard Lynch vibes going on, and he's pretty decent. I really like Jack Nance in here, and he narrates throughout the movie, which is kind of strange. This is the best kind of watch I've had for the Ghoulies. I've always felt like it was the second worst of the franchise after part four. I mean, two is my absolute favorite. I like three. I feel like four is the worst, directed by, I can't believe I forgot, Jim Wynorski. And he brings back the original actor from the first one and some of the black magic side of angles and everything. But it doesn't have Ghoulies in it. They're just like kind of small people playing Ghoulies. Not really that great. But this one has a satanic angle and a bunch of Ghoulies. There is an R-rated version of this. It's not on this disc. It's kind of rare. I don't think it's ever been remastered and released or anything like that. But for the most part, or even was probably lost pretty much from my understanding. There's a VHS, I think, that was released. But my understanding is this, you know, it's not around. So that's why it's not on here. But Ghoulies is actually a better than I remembered. You know, the last time I watched, I was a little harsh on it. I've kind of come around a lot on Ghoulies just growing up with it and just kind of knowing what to expect. It's well shot. The score is done well, partially done by Richard Band, Charles Band's brother. So it's got like a lot of professional aspects about it. It's a low budget, but it's a lot like Spookies, kind of a lot of everything in the kitchen sink, although less inept than Spookies for obvious reasons. But as far as the special features are concerned, you're going to be looking at kind of the same special features that the Scream Factory double feature Blu-ray had with Ghoulies 1 and 2, long out of print. There's also a German version that you could import, but why when there's a 4K from MVD? But what it does have new is a 2023 4K restoration, 16-bit scan of the original camera negative. It looks really good. Has HDR. Looks damn good. And way better than Ghoulies you would ever expect Ghoulies to look. I was really impressed with the presentation of the film. And then we also have our archival audio commentary with the director. Another one moderated by Jason Alderson of Terror Transmission. I listened to a little bit of that. And you know, like when you have like Charlie Band and the director talking, their stories don't always match up where Ghoulies came from and everything, but it's fairly close, I guess. And then there's a Blu-ray in here as well, which has the new master, the two commentaries, but also has a video introduction by the director, editing an Empire interview with Ted Nicolodi, who directed a bunch of films, including Terror Vision. The Mind is a Terrible Thing to Waste, interview with Scott Thompson, who's an actor in the film, Just for the Chick Man, interview with the director, From Toilets to Terror, The Making of Ghoulies, which has a slew of people in there. They're 30 minutes. There's a lot of long interviews. So if you're a huge fan of Ghoulies and you got to see it in 4K, I would recommend it. It's a nice release of a movie that I'm starting to come around to. Like, I love the sequels, the first two sequels, and I felt like the first one was a little kind of a step back. I know people really like the satanic angle here, and of course the creatures coming out of the toilet is infamous Ghoulies. Yeah, they'll get you in the end. I love that tagline. All right, my hair's looking crazy here. So let's hop into Ghoulies 2. All right, that is the sequel to Ghoulies. Not on 4K, unfortunately. MVD said that they looked for the elements. They didn't really have them to do a 4K master. So we have it on Blu-ray. It's been long out of print in the States, so be happy that Ghoulies 2 is here. I think they changed the tagline on here. They'll get yours in the end. I thought it was they'll get you in the end again. Maybe that's just the tagline of the trailer. But Ghoulies 2, 1987, directed by Albert Band. That's Charlie Band's father. And this was predominantly like a whole entire Italian like crew. And I mentioned that. I know the first one, a lot of the Empire Pictures had those as well. And this was shot over in Europe, probably like Romania, Italy kind of area. But honestly, I mentioned that because it really stands out. Besides the American cast and everything like that, there is some Italian actors in here, and Mickey Knox, who isn't Italian, but he worked in Italy a lot. He's in Cemetery Man. He used to do voiceover work for, you know, the Sergio Leone movies and stuff like that. He's great in this. And there's also Romano Pupo, and you'll recognize some other people in the background that were famous kind of Italian or character actors and whatnot. That's really great to see. But the crew is also Italian. So besides Richard Band's great score, which was also so good, they used it for Ghost Town, another Empire picture. You have Sergio Salvetti, which is really impressive. That was Lucio Fulci's DP. So Ghoulies 2, like it or not, it's really well shot. It has that Italian flair to it. So that's one of the reasons I've always loved this film from being a very little kid. I've always loved his cinematography in, you know, Fulci's movies and apparently in Ghoulies 2. The main cast has the girl in here is from Pumpkinhead, and she's in, she's in another one too, but she's the iconic kind of character that gets lifted up. You know, and Pumpkinhead has her. It's a really memorable scene. Phil Fondacaro is in here, kind of an Empire regular. It's also got Royal Dano, who's an excellent actor. He's a character actor that's appeared as a drunk more than anyone else besides maybe Buck Flower. I mean, he's in Messiah of Evil, Something Wicked This Way Comes, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, If He Hollers. He's an excellent actor. He's in a slew of things. He's great in this as Uncle Ned. So essentially the plot of Ghoulies 2 is, in the very beginning, we have kind of a priest who's grabbed a bunch of ghoulies and he's going to try to get rid of them. A cult's chasing him. He stops in a roadside, like kind of like truck stop, and he's going to throw them in a giant vat of toxic waste, which just in the late 80s and early 90s will lead you to believe that vats of toxic waste were just laying everywhere. See RoboCop from the same year. So he tries to dispose of the ghoulies, but it doesn't work. When Bat Ghoulie flies in and knocks him in the vat of waste, the other four ghoulies that he tried to melt, I guess, besides Bat Ghoulie, kind of rise from it in a really iconic scene where you have some memorable previous ones like the fish and the cat and the rat. And we kind of introduce to like the toad or whatever the fuck he is, Ghoulie, who's my personal favorite ghoulie. So, and the bat. So we have our ghoulies. Of course, this kind of traveling circus is passing through with Royal Dano and his nephew, and they decide to stop to kind of stop the radiator from overheating. They run a spook house is what they call it, and the signs on there are called Satan's Den. So the ghoulies see that. They think, hey, that's home. They crawl into the back of the truck, and they end up in this kind of crazy little haunted sideshow attraction at a carnival. So it's really great that Ghoulies 2 takes place in a carnival, which is a great staple of horror films and film noir and everything like that. I love carnival horror films. I also love, like I said, that shot in kind of the Italy with the Italian crew and has a bunch of character actors in there. It's also written by Dennis Paoli, who wrote a lot of Stuart Gordon stuff. He wrote Reanimator and some other things, so he's a really capable writer. Dolls. So we're looking at so much talent behind Ghoulies 2, not to mention produced by Charles Band, scored by Richard Band, directed by Albert Band, who's done a slew of films. So we're looking at more talent than Ghoulies 2 should probably have. Carl Buechler did the effects, and the effects are really strong in here. I think the ghoulies never looked better. The stop motion stuff they use is really good, or the kind of computer, whatever they use when they kind of move and stuff. It, obviously, you could tell it's an old special effect, which I enjoy. But it's just a lot of fun, especially when the final climax breaks out and all the ghoulies attack the circus. We have Wasp on the soundtrack, Scream Until You Like It, which is absolute blast. It's just a fun, goofy movie. I mean, it's mostly made for kids, although some of the stuff could be disturbing. You got Billy Butler in there, super young. You got somebody from Dazed and Confused making an early appearance in here. So it's just a lot of fun. It's a very quotable, very silly, very cute movie. Royal Dano's character is just really sad and tragic, to be brutally honest. Like, in the opening when he's talking about the moon, and he's like, that's the fullest moon I ever seen. It's a magic moon, nephew. It's just, it seems really depressing and really genuinely real. Like, like I said, a lot of the early Empire and Full Moon movies really just felt like they were kids' movies with gore. And this one has a little bit of gore. There is an R-rated version of this if you get the German import, but all that stuff is just standard def spliced in. And some of the kills are just a little bit more graphic. They're included as deleted scenes here, as they were on the Scream Factory Blu-ray as well. As far as the special features are concerned, we have a high definition presentation. Then we have subtitles, of course, introduction by screenwriter Dennis Paoli, More Toilets, More Terror, The Making of Ghoulies 2, Under a Magic Moon, Interview with Dennis Paoli, deleted scenes, photo gallery, theatrical trailer, two-sided artwork, collectible, mini poster. So anyways, yeah, this is one of my favorite kind of little creature movies, if not my all-time favorite. I'm not telling you it's better than Critters 1 or 2. I'm not telling you it's better than Gremlins 1 or 2. I'm telling you it's my personal favorite. I will tell you it's better than Ghoulies 1. I'll take that to the grave. But Ghoulies 2, 1987, just if you like these kind of movies, I really recommend it. It's one of the best of its kind. Empire or kind of Ghoulies, little creatures, little critter kind of deals. I think it's one of the best ones. So check out Ghoulies 2. It looks pretty good, solid. I don't remember. I don't think the original Blu-rays from Scream Factory had subtitles. I might be wrong on that, but these ones both do. Okay, the next one is from Arrow Video, and this is The Prodigal Son. And this is, of course, Golden Harvest, and it's directed by Sammo Hung. Now, Sammo Hung is a mixed martial artist who's done a slew of movies. He's directed a bunch of movies. He's really great. He's kind of like a unique martial artist where nobody's quite just like him. He directed Warriors 2 before this, and he basically the lead in that is in this one as well. And it shares a lot of the same DNA. This plot is actually a little bit different than a lot of the other, you know, Golden Harvest and Shaw Brothers movies. Like, I'm not trying to be rude, but a lot of them do follow. They're very formulaic, kind of like slasher movies or something like that in the same vein. This time we have kind of this son whose dad and mother are very rich, and his mother basically forces the father to basically pay people to fall down for the son and fight. So the son never gets hurt. So the son's going around town, like, challenging everyone, looking for fights, and he's whooping everyone beyond belief. In the very beginning, it's an amazing scene where there's a couple guys in this tea house, and one falls over and hits his back, and then you realize that they're paying these guys to lose. And this guy finds out the hard way when he travels. He kind of challenges this really effeminate kind of guy who travels in this kind of like musical troupe, and this guy whomps him, embarrasses him completely, and says, you're a fraud. They pay you and everything, and he has like a sidekick that goes around and pays for all the fights. It's very funny, but after he realizes that, he's greatly shamed, and he wants to follow this guy around and learn from him. So basically his father buys his way in this troop, and he's traveling around trying to learn, but there is kind of a lord going around. He's in the government, and he's a badass, mean-spirited guy, and there's a great scene that's ripped right out of Good and Bad and Ugly, where this guy runs up to him and says, you broke my arm and I learned how to fight with my left arm. And you're like, okay, that's the El Tuco scene, right? Where he shot the guy and he learned to shoot with his left arm. Don't talk, shoot. That whole scene right there. And they redo this whole scene here. And then, of course, this guy just smashes his legs. And the guy's bodyguards are like, come back when you learn how to fight with without your legs, or something like that. So this guy's a badass. And he wants to challenge this musical artist, this kind of theater troupe guy. He doesn't want anything to do with it. He doesn't want to fight for glory anymore, any of those things. But there's some shady things and some bad guys doing some awful things. And there's this really graphic scene in the middle of this movie that comes out of nowhere where you're like, this movie's kind of lighthearted, kind of silly, kind of fun. And that scene comes out and you're just like, wow, it's just a bunch of people being brutally massacred. And I was like, we're in a different movie right now. We are not in the same movie. It just gets really crazy and dark. And then Sammo Hung enters the picture and he's fun in it as well. He plays the theater troupe guy's like older brother who's smarter and faster and a better fighter. And there's a lot of that. There's this whole long training montage until we come to the finale and everything, and we get the reveal of what happened. This is a good movie. It's different and unique in comparison to some of the other Golden Harvest and Shaw Brothers movies. It has a lot of the same DNA, but it's not your typical thing. I enjoyed this one. As far as the special features are concerned, we have commentaries by, we have a bunch of different audio tracks and choices and everything like that. Commentary by mixed martial arts experts Frank Jin and actor Bobby Samuels. I enjoyed that because Bobby Samuels worked with a lot of these guys, so he can make comments about them. Like, oh, he was really cool, this guy here, I met him. So that's inside, like, just knows these guys. It's a true thing. He's really into the commentary by action experts Mike Leader and Artie Vimoa. Wing Chun 101, interview with Wing Chun, Saifu, Alex Richter, Life Imitating Art, archival featurette featuring interviews with Wing Chang, instructor and producer Guy Lau, talking about the art, illustrated via demonstrations by Sifu Austin, and Jude Poyer. The Heroic Trio archival interview featuring interviews with Sammo Hung and stars Yoon Boyne and Frankie Chan. Looking back on the making of the film, archival interview with Guy Lau. Original theatrical trailers, double-sided fold-out poster featuring original and newly commissioned artwork by Joe Kim. So yeah, there's all sorts of stuff on this. It looks good and it sounds good. I don't know if I love the cover art. I don't hate it, but it's very much, it's just very computer generated looking to me. Like, I don't know, that's a style, and a lot of people like it. I don't hate it. I just don't know how I particularly feel about it. You got the original cover art on the inside anyway, so it's not really that big of a deal. But this one's pretty enjoyable. Good stuff. Okay, this next one is from Mondo Macabro, and this is a doozy. This is called The Fear from 1966, and this is a Greek film by, I'm going to mispronounce this guy's name. I don't even know if I should try. Kostas Manousakis. That was bad. But it's a very hard name to say, and I never heard of this film. It's very much a psychological kind of thriller, very, very progressive and kind of insanely depressing for the time. It's shot gorgeously. It's filmed gorgeous. The acting performances are really well done. There's a lot of silent performances that show and don't tell, a lot of uncomfortability. It's about a patriarchal society in Greece, kind of a, I guess I would say, secluded area where there's a father and a mother, and they have the mother, this is like her stepson here, this is the father's boy. He's slow and he's sexually repressed and he's just not right. And he works on this farm and they are well off and they have a lot of help. Helpers that are around, including a mute girl. The daughter comes back from college, and she's going to go to college. She comes back from university a bit, I believe, and she kind of shakes the things up a little bit, and we have this weird kind of scenario with all these people here. And There's some really kind of disturbing scenes, like you see that the men go out and they sleep with prostitutes whenever they want and neglect their wives. There's a really depressing scene of the relationship between the parents about him going to her door when he's drunk. And it's just a lot of things said and family kind of drama stuff that's really disturbing. And it's all leading up to, obviously, a rape and eventually even a murder. And how they handle it and how they cover it up and the power dynamic switching. What I loved about the movie, besides like the acting performances and what it had to say and the psychological aspects of it, was the cinematography. If you guys ever seen like John Roland movies, when he has like free range, he'll use scope really well. Not even scope, he'll just show like, I guess, location of the characters, how isolated they can really be. And he does that really well in like Grapes of Death, where you'll be on focus, you'll be focused on a character and it will zoom all the way back. And this, and he's not the only guy to do it, right? When I'm thinking art film, I'm thinking thriller, horror pictures, I think John Roland when it comes to this kind of style. And he's like zoomed in on somebody and you don't even know you're in a zoom, and he pulls all the way out and you see them in the middle of this countryside, this beautiful countryside, or by a lake walking. And they do that here, but it's got a really kind of profound, kind of disturbing effect when they do that. And they do it two or three times and it's gorgeous, these kind of fields and everything like that, but all this disturbing stuff is happening underneath the surface. At one point, the son, he has this conversation with this other guy and he's telling him about, you know, all these messed up sexual kind of things and whatnot. And it kind of like, it kind of pushes him to go to that next step or where he's at. But it's a disturbing movie. It's obviously about repressed sexuality and kind of a fucked up society. I would really recommend checking it out. It's a gorgeous movie. It's really well done. It's really well acted. And it's got some special features on here, documentary about the film and the director, gallery of stills and artwork. And that documentary is like 40 minutes long. So it's good stuff. Interesting stuff. It's an archival one that probably broadcast on television there. But yeah, I would recommend checking this one out. It's called The Fear from 1966. And Mondo Macabro does it again, releasing a gem that I never heard of. Okay, we have an anime here from 1987. Kind of an infamous one. This is one that I had never seen. And this is Wicked City. I wanted to rectify that. So yeah, I heard a lot of good things about Wicked City. And it delivered pretty much. Now, I didn't love it as much as I thought I would. I preferred like Demon City and Vampire Hunter D, and even Ninja Scroll over it, but I did like it. So basically what we have here is, in the future we have these kind of alien creatures that they're kind of like shapeshifters, I guess, like think kind of Zoonoid deal. And they're not exactly alien creatures, they're from like a different dimension. It's really weird and really bizarre. And what they want is, they're like working together kind of Men in Black style to kind of stop like an evil like terrorist group with it, that is like these kind of dark people, like dark, I don't know what they remember what they call them, but they want to like basically kill this guy who's working to make the peace talks. There's this old man that the government agents need to get to protect at all costs, because there's going to be a group of terrorists that want to kill him. So he's a cranky, perverted old man, and he's got a lot of comedy beats in here because he's just completely inappropriate and horned up and just disgusting. But these two are supposed to protect him. One is human and one is from this different dimension. She's a gorgeous female woman. In the very beginning of the movie, there's a great sex scene where this agent is picked up by this mantis woman. He doesn't know she's a mantis woman. And he basically sleeps with her and she tries to kill him afterwards. And he escapes at the last minute. And she actually comes back into the movie later on. But the bad guys in this movie are excellent. You see like four or five of them. In the very beginning, there's a couple that try to take him out. And they're just awesome. It reminds me very much of The Thing, kind of the style, how you shoot something off or they grow their eyes out longer and everything like that. But just really effective, really cool monsters and characters. I just wish there was a little bit more to the story, actually. I wish there was more monsters, more villains, more characters. It feels like it could have been a little longer. They could have went more into it. But you get a glimpse at a lot of the stuff and it's really cool. The bad guys are great. The effects of how they move is great. I have a Hong Kong version of this, a live action version, a Hong Kong movie from the early 90s that I love to watch, which I watch soon enough if I can. But I liked Wicked City. I thought it was good stuff. And there's obviously a little twist in here, but I like the characters. I like the mythology. At times it reminded me of John Wick. At times it reminded me of The Thing, and it reminded me of Guyver. All these kind of things into one. Wicked City, good stuff. Okay, guys, let's hop into those 1981 movies.
Woe be unto him who opens one of the seven gateways to hell, because through that gateway, evil will invade the world.
Thank you. Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. In this little town, when the 14th comes round, there's a silence and fear in the air. Remember the morn that the legend was born, all the shock and the horror was there. Or the legend they say on a Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on and on. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago.
Okay, the first up is from the Angel Gut series. That's right. This is not necessarily a horror film, but it's horror adjacent for sure. So get your pervert cards out here. We're going to the Angel Guts territory. Now, there are six of these movies. This set has five. This is from Arts Magic. I don't know if the sixth one, what is it called? Red Flash is technically one. It's kind of iffy. I believe it is. It's a very good movie. But this one is going to be Angel Guts Red Porno from 1981, of course. So this is the director of Evil Dead Trap, so that's kind of horror adjacent there. And this one does have some kind of horror elements or elements that would interest a horror fan. And it's got some really dark subject matter about stalking and all that kind of stuff. Oh, of course I spilled the coffee, but we're going to be okay. We're going to finish this review first. So I was looking at Letterboxd, and somebody pointed out some stuff that I thought was really interesting. They had basically Black Swan at the top 2010, then they had Perfect Blue, then they had Durfan from 82, and then they had this one underneath. And they were like, this movie is like, these four movies are like a great trajectory, and it all starts with Angel Guts Red Porno. I was like, you know what? I've seen all three of those movies, and I'm watching this, and I'm like, I do see that. I really do see the trajectory there, right? Because if you watch like people being forced into this kind of performance, and it just fucks them up and it changes their entire outlook of life and everything. So this story is really kind of sad and depressing, and it's broken up in a different way. It's not like chronological order exactly. So in the very beginning, we see these flashes of this poor girl tied up in bondage and everything, and you're like, what is this? Is she enjoying it? Obviously, it doesn't look like she typically is, but then we kind of find out that she went to help her friend and fill in for a job, but they ended up tying her up and putting her in bondage and filming it, and in Japan, they had these porn magazines, and her magazine went like really popular. So it's all over Japan, and she's this kind of person that just works at this like kind of this dress store and everything like that. So she basically becomes like this sexual phenomenon to people. There's this stalker that's obsessed with her, and we see a lot of the stuff that he watches, including somebody putting an egg up inside of them in a weird masturbation scene. So yes, there is some pervert stuff like that. There is fetish stuff in here. It's kind of like a pinky film, of course, right? Nikatsu movie. So anyways, what happens is the stalker obviously fixes on her, and he starts to watch her and focus on her while she's basically forced into this affair with somebody she works with, and it's basically a rape scene here. Pretty dark stuff, but she starts to have a relationship with him until eventually he finds out about the magazine, and there's people from that group trying to pull her back in to do more and everything like that. And it's just weird. She has like a weird feeling and relationship with the attention and with the magazine and things like that, because she was very non-sexual person. Reminds me a little bit of Goodnight Miss Wyckoff, if that makes any sense to anybody. But as the movie progresses, I see a lot of similarities too. There was one last year, kind of like The Sex Hunter 1980, but I think it's more along the lines of, what is the one where the character rapes people and he sets them on fire? I'm asking you guys, even though I covered it, but there's so many movies I can't think. It might have been the same director, Ikeda. It might have been Ikeda again. I believe that's the same guy. And it does have similarities to that, but there's this great scene when the character, the stalker, provokes her, and it's like a beautiful scene. It's shot really well. Beautiful cinematography, beautiful 1981 locations out in the city, roaming the streets. And there's a really great ending with a lot of downfall. And she basically confronts him. And it says things like, you know, these stalkers are the people, they're obsessed with ideas of people. They're not really obsessed with the person. They're not really obsessed or love the person. They're just obsessed with longing and wanting and the idea of having that person. And it's dark. And it's a disturbing, kind of depressing movie. And it's good, though. I really liked it. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Angel Guts Red Porno. The title alone just suggests that it would be more graphic than it is. But it's interesting stuff, good stuff. And Japan doesn't have that many horror movies from the early 80s. We wait till we get to the mid to late 80s and early 90s, where they, like, flood the market with tons of direct-to-video stuff. Of course, the guinea pig films and Gozu and all these kind of bizarre Cyclops 1980s, late 80s, like, crazy movies that are really cool. But in the beginning, there was just kind of pinky films that crossed the line. There's stuff in the 60s, of course, a lot of ghost stories and monster movies, and even in the 70s you have a couple like Beautiful Hunter. I can't think, the really fucked up one from 79, Hunter of Jude, I can't remember, Star of David. It's weird ass movie, but yeah, this one right here is interesting for sure. Angel Guts Red Porno, that set of course is out of print, it's very expensive, but there's HD masters of the first five Angel Gut movies floating around, if I'm not mistaken, and I'd love to see them get wider releases. I'd love to see them get stateside releases. I know Synapse has been doing the Nakatsus over here. Come on, do the Angel Guts movies. We deserve the Angel Guts movies on Blu-ray. I don't know. What's the holdup? The next one from 1981 is an Italian flick. Not as many Italian flicks, I don't think, from this year as the previous year, but there's a handful. And this one is by one of the maestros here. This is from Riccardo Freda. This is Murder Obsession. Now, I seen this one years ago. This is a rare Blu-ray. So we're going to hop into this one. This one reminds me a bit of Blood Delirium. Kind of has the plot of, you know, forgotten past. Now, it's a supernatural giallo. There's some supernatural touches in there. Although I feel like a lot of the supernatural touches don't really amount to much. So we have a young boy who had a lot of trauma happen to him when he's a very young kid, and he has not been home ever since. His mother is Anita Strindberg, who's in a slew of things. We also have Laura Gemser in here, of course, Black Emmanuel herself. So what happens is he works in film, and he comes back to his old house to kind of film some stuff, bring some of his movie friends with him, a secretary who's actually his girlfriend. And what happens is weird things start to happen right away. His girlfriend has a crazy gothic dream with a giant rubber spider and zombies that spit goo out. It's really weird and doesn't really fit in place, but it kind of plays into the supernatural aspects. And we learn what happened to this poor boy. He, at a young age, he murdered his father, played by the same actor, of course, but we're not going to really sure exactly what happened. There is a mysterious kind of butler hanging around the premises. The mother is sick. All these kind of things play into red herring gothic style things, right? And what happens is people start getting picked off. There's plenty of nudity, plenty of sex and whatnot, but maybe not too much sex, but there is a handful of nudity. And then we have a double reveal at the very end. Now, the first reveal, you're like, oh shit, and then the second reveal is even more fun. But yeah, this one, I do like this. I think it's interesting. I think it's decent. I think it's kind of crazy that Riccardo Freda, you know, he was basically the mentor to Mario Bava, or Mario Bava worked with Riccardo Freda a lot. You know, he's the one who let him finish Caltiki, or had him finish Caltiki. It depends who's telling you the story. But so it's weird that Riccardo Freda is still making horror movies, and Mario Bava, the guy who learned from him, or worked under him, is dead already in 1981. That's sad. But Riccardo Freda did a couple more, of course. The Horrible Dr. Hitchcock. And he had, what is it? I know there's a couple I covered on here. Did he do The Iguana and the Tongue of Fire? So, I mean, he's got a nice, decent amount of filmography in Italian horror and gothic films. One of the first ones to do kind of the gothic style. But Murder Obsession's kind of late in the game, right? It's not quite giallo, not quite gothic horror, kind of a mixture of both. Maybe in the same lines of like Seven Deaths in a Cat's Eye by Antonio Margheriti. But it's decent, it's solid, it's got a good location, of course. The longer version here is the Italian version, and there's a shorter English version, which is about 5 minutes shorter. I went with the Italian version. I enjoyed it for the most part. It's nice seeing Laura Gemser not being a Joe D'Amato movie. Not that there's anything wrong with Joe D'Amato, of course, but it's kind of a nice surprise here. Anyways, Murder Obsession, some people list it as one of the worst movies in 1981. Not even close. I liked it. I'm also an aficionado of Italian cinema, and it's been years since I watched this one. The only hit on it is probably, it's not the most memorable movie in the world, which, you know, but hey, sometimes that happens. Basically, with special features here, we have interview with Stivaletti, that is the special effects artist, Sergio Stivaletti, not Salvetti. Confusing, right? Interview with Claudio Simonetti, composer and founder of Goblin, which is cool. Interview with Gabriel Albanese, director, new and improved English subtitles, digitally stored cutscene footage, English language version of the film, a fully illustrated booklet containing critical analysis of the film by Chris Alexander from Fangoria Magazine, a director himself. So yeah, check it out. Murder Obsession. You could do a lot worse. It's pretty decent if you like Italian cinema. Okay, the next one here is super bizarre. And if you read the description, it's like Killer Puppets, and it's an Asian film. Is this one? I believe this one is probably a Hong Kong flick as well. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know too much about this one. It's called Life After Life. Bizarre film, okay? Not much on this one, but it was super interesting. So in the very beginning, we're like in the 50s, and we have this kind of this graphic murder and this like stuff burning down. You don't get to see everything. It's just kind of a glimpse at it. And it appears that somebody's been beaten with a puppet, or a puppet's killed somebody. It's a really bizarre scene. We kind of fast forward like 29 years later. And it was really funny because I started this on August 29th when I was watching it. And then I finished it August 30th. And there's a bunch of, it's about reincarnation and all these kind of like a circular loop that you get trapped in, and all the characters burn. Birthdays was August 29th, and I was like, man, if I would have known that, I would have forced myself to finish it that night. It was kind of late, so I didn't want to finish it, but it's very funny that, right, they have that whole kind of reincarnation thing, and I actually would have finished it on the day, not knowing what the hell it was about. So we have this kind of, I don't remember exactly his job, he like works in lights and stuff like that, and they're basically trying to make some sort of like, is it a music video or something like that, something with film, and this guy has, a thing with for the model here. They have a thing, a relationship, and there's a producer on the side that's starting to kind of create this love triangle deal. And all three of these characters end up kind of being intertwined with this whole kind of reincarnation thing. As it goes on, you get closer and closer and realize that it's kind of inevitable, that there's going to be some sort of fate kind of thing here, fate kind of deal, curse. It's interesting. There's lots of good visuals and weird kind of stuff going on. Lots of curses, lots of people being killed. Not lots, a couple. But it's visually, it has some really wild moments of like kind of like crazy kind of almost like space stuff. And I like the idea that we kind of like implement like this person working on cinema. It definitely reminds me of like kind of an Italian inspired kind of horror film as well. But I enjoyed this one. Don't be fooled. It's not exactly a killer puppet movie. It is a nice little mystery here, but it is horror, obviously due to kind of the subject matter, the murders and supernatural elements. But Life After Life is an interesting oddball film that I don't think many people have seen. And I think it's definitely one of the, I guess you'd say, hidden gems from 1981. I think if it got a release and maybe some more eyes on it, some critical analysis on it by some other people, some, you know, commentaries or whatever, I think this movie could probably be much more popular than it is. I enjoyed it. It's unique. It's different. It's weird. And I like the idea kind of like seeing your fate coming up and you don't stop it, similar to Fulci's Psychic, right? Where you're like, you know, this is going to happen. You got to try to stop it. Or by the time you realize what's going to happen, it's all far too late. So it's kind of got that going for it too. But this is Life After Life. And the last one from 1981 is a spoofy, weird movie. And this is The Creature Wasn't Nice, or Spaceship, or it's got a couple other titles here. And this is a take on 2001. It's a take on Alien. It's all sorts of nonsense. And this stars Leslie Nielsen and Patrick Macney. Not Magny, Macney. And there's somebody else in here, too. I feel like I'm forgetting somebody. But, one of the lead actors in here is also the director. And this is a super silly movie. Leslie Nielsen's kind of doing the stick where he plays it straight, you know. I never knew this movie existed. I didn't know anything about it, but I'm seeing it on 81. That Creature Wasn't Nice, a.k.a. Spaceship. I was like, why not? Let's check it out. Oh boy. So, like I said, it's an alien riff, and these astronauts are on here, or these, I don't even know what the hell they are. They get an alien creature on their ship, and he does singing and dancing, as you would expect, and they translate him at one point, and he sings, "I Want to Eat Your Leg." And the funny thing is, there's Patrick Macney is actually really funny in this. If you guys don't know him, he's from the television show The Avengers, I believe, but I know him mostly from like Waxwork and other horror films like that. And he's super cheesy in this and always happy. He's kind of playing the Ash character, where he, no matter how, he's more silly in the aspect, he's a scientific thing, and he just completely misinterprets everything. Leslie Nielsen's character is just a character that like hears things and he repeats them like very matter-of-factly. And there's a couple moments where I laughed out loud. There's a couple moments where I just was like, for the most part, this is very kind of, you know, Airplane came out the year before. Leslie Nielsen, you wanted to put him in a movie. Patrick Macney is the best part of the film, to be honest. Oh, Garrett Graham's also in here. How could I forget Garrett Graham? He's wearing the kind of trucker hat thing, like Harry Dean Stanton would wear. He's okay in it. He's got his moments too. So like, it's got a lot of funny people in it, a lot of talented people. It doesn't necessarily work. There's a couple moments that had me laughing out loud, but I really can't vouch for this. I can barely remember anything from it. It's a very silly, goofy movie that doesn't have much of a lasting effect. It is The Creature Wasn't Nice, or Spaceship. You can find it on YouTube if you must. Okay, guys, the Patreon pick is, of course, think Jim Simon picked this, Roadhouse from 1989. Oh boy, I hadn't watched Roadhouse in so long. And you know, back in the day, I wasn't the biggest fan of Roadhouse. I was like, it's overrated because there was so much talk about Roadhouse all the time. But watching it again, I knew that I would love it. And rewatching it, I enjoyed the hell out of it. I didn't remember that Dean Cundey did the cinematography. So it's like Roadhouse is shot all awesome and in widescreen. Like, what the fuck is happening? So of course, this is kind of a cult classic. And this is a crazy cult classic. MGM put this out. It stars Patrick Swayze as a cooler, a guy who basically he's a professional bouncer to kind of stop fights from happening in these rowdy bars. It also has Sam Elliott, who's his mentor. It has, Ben Gazzara as this kind of rich kind of asshole that runs a city. A bunch of other people that you'll recognize in here, including Terry Funk, RIP, Chainsaw Charlie from Wrestling It. And who is the, there's a female in here. I can't believe I'm forgetting her name. I feel like a complete tool bag. She's in a slew of movies, and she's really good in this too. There's also a lot of other characters. Actors in here that you would recognize. The heavy guy from Cheerleader Camp is in here as a bouncer. Kelly Lynch. I thought it was Kelly Lynch, but I wanted to make sure. So Dalton in Patrick Swayze is hired to kind of clean up this really rowdy bar where there's fights every night, crazy, ridiculous, over-the-top fights. They always have a live band, which is excellent and plays amazing music, covers of great songs. And so Patrick Swayze goes in there and he immediately starts working on there. He starts firing people left and right. And before long, he realizes that he's not just cleaning up a bar, he's cleaning up the town. Because Ben Gazzara is a crooked son of a bitch. He makes all the local shops pay him, and all the business owners hate it, including he starts to kind of fall for this doctor, this local doctor in Kelly Lynch, who is the niece of Red, who runs one of the hardware store. So he's directly involved with this. And of course, Kelly Lynch was directly involved with Ben Gazzara as well. Oh no, they were going to get married. Ben Gazzara is a millionaire and he surrounds himself with the most ridiculous goons of all time. He eventually picks up Terry Funk after he's fired, but there's a slew of them. Of course, the martial artist guy in this, he has a lot of infamous lines. Everybody knows it. The prison line, which is almost out of place in this almost silly movie. You're like, what? What the fuck did he say? But it also has Anthony DeLongis. Is that how you say his name? He plays Blade in Master of the Universe. I love Master of the Universe, so I was like, oh shit, it's hard to recognize him, but after you see it, it's him. He's one of the main goons as well. He's like a guy who's a villain in here. I got a lot of cheesy bad guys, all very memorable. And of course, they get their ass whooped a bunch. The fight scenes are really excellent and really kind of hard hitting and over the top. So, like, there's giant bar scenes, which remind me of, like, you know, the classic Western bar scenes times 10. It's super sleazy too. This movie is so fucking horny. A lot of sex, a lot of complete, like, I don't even know what to call it. Like, it's a dummy movie, right? It's just a dummy movie. And like Stephen King, I was listening to like people talking about Maximum Overdrive. I can't remember what podcast had Maximum Overdrive on there. They were tearing it apart. I love Maximum Overdrive. I know it's not good. I actually think it was Pick Six Movies, maybe they did it. I can't think. It was somebody like that. But they tore Maximum Overdrive apart and they were saying Stephen King wanted to make a dummy movie. And I mean, Roadhouse is a dummy movie, and I don't mean that as an insult. It's a shut your brain off and enjoy yourself. Sam Elliott is great in here. He's got a lot of good one-liners. He's like, I guess, like the white trash, a sex appeal times 10 for everybody. He's got a lot of good lines. Great stuff. And there's just like I said, I just enjoy the whole thing. It's all fighting. It's all shooting. It's all fucking. It's just sleazy. I just wish that like movie companies made movies like this. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I want like studios to release movies like this again. Just have some fucking fun with it. Have some guts. Have some balls. I guess I'm kind of just disappointed that, like, what's making money now? Like, Roadhouse used to make money. Stuff like this used to make money. And now, like, the stuff that makes money is just stuff that I'm burnt out on. I'm sure people didn't really love Roadhouse. Some of people, when it came out, probably were like, this is the dumbest thing ever. But the end fight scene's really great. And it's fun watching Ben Gazzara over time just lose his mind. Like, he becomes more and more unhinged as it progresses. But, totally sometimes it's a little all over the place. Like, this guy will get massacred brutally and then the next scene they'll be like, polar bear fell on me, and everybody's like, eh. I mean, it is a goofy movie, and tonally it's like, eh, I don't know. I like how it looks. It looks really good. Like I said, Dean Cundey, the 4K looks excellent. There's features on here. There's one Blu-ray with all the archival stuff on here. Then there's a new Blu-ray that has interviews with a ton of the people that did a lot of the stunts on there, which is one of the most important aspects of Roadhouse, let's be honest. They talk about working with Patrick Swayze and how he was a natural, being a dancer and everything like that. So as far as the new special features are concerned, we have, of course, the 5.1 and HDR 4K, and we have a commentary with a bunch of people on here. But the new features, I'll go on the new features here. We have a henchman to a brand new interview with actor stuntman Anthony DeLongis. I did it my way, a brand new interview with second unit director stunt coordinator Charlie Picanerni. Blonde Ambition's a brand new interview with actress Laura Lee Kazan. Fighting Man, a brand new interview with Roger Hewlett. Ain't Nothing Gonna Kill Me But Me, a brand new interview with actor Travis McKenna. Original theatrical trailer, all that kind of stuff is the new stuff. And then we have archival stuff, of course, on here. Just a lot of fun, a memorable movie for sure, a cult classic, and I really enjoyed revisiting it. I was just like, man, if all movies were as easy to watch as Roadhouse, I'd never leave the couch, right? Good stuff. Questions, comments, concerns, all that jazz. Bad Brains Horror 3613. Hey, Dave, are you picking up Hen and Letter's Bad Biology from Severin? I already got it coming. Did the whole bundle on that bad boy. He says, great episode. Just read the Kubrick's favorite film was Eraserhead, and he showed it to the cast and crew of The Shining. That is amazing. Had no idea. That is batshit, but I believe it. I heard that, too. I didn't know it was his favorite film, but I know he showed it to his cast and crew. Nick Mua, interesting perspective on The Entity. I'll watch it with a different mindset now. Barbara Hershey gives it the movie heart, though. I was so pleased to see her make a horror comeback with Black Swan and even more cookie-cutter Insidious films. Questions. Do you have an example of a so-so horror movie that gets elevated by the lead actor? The Entity. Sorry. Don't Answer the Phone is a movie I really love, but a huge chunk of that is Nicholas Wirth. I think that's a big one. Do you like any of the based on true story horror flicks? I love Henry. I love Confessions of a Serial Killer. I mean, they're not accurate to the story, but at least you can buy some of it. I do have issues. I mean, I like The Exorcist, right? That's technically based on a true story. Jaws has some truth to it, but I mean, they're not all that true. I do have issues with like stuff like The Conjuring. I just like whatever. Three, do male scream queens or scream kings exist? I guess you could say they do. I mean, I don't know how you define a scream queen. I mean, you think they would have to scream, but if it's just somebody who's in a bunch of movies or whatnot, I mean, do they always have to play victim or the final girl or whatnot? The term scream queen, you either know which one is not. Like, Jamie Lee Curtis is a scream queen, yes, but, like, true scream queen would be, like, Brink Stevens, Linnea Quigley, Michelle Bauer, you know, that kind of deal. And then if you get, like, the original scream queens, you got, like, Jamie Lee Curtis, Heather Langenkamp, but a lot of them don't do that many movies. There's actresses that put their whole career, you know, in that. So, scream kings, like, is it people that play victims a lot in movies? Because like a guy that's killed in 50 horror movies won't be as remembered, you know, if he's just getting killed in slasher films as a female who is. It's kind of strange like that. But if you're talking about like Jeffrey Combs or Robert Englund, I mean, they're horror icons, but I wouldn't call them scream kings. I love The Alien Factor, one of my favorite sci-fi B movies. So that was I Kid 3240. Petri Lempoli 8204. It's been 20 years at least since I saw The Entity, but I can still hear the loud banging noise when the attacks took place. It reminded me very much of Maximum Overdrive, right? But just better done. I love Maximum Overdrive, like I said, but that whole bam, 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 it's a lot like that. The use of sound was really effective. I remember the feeling the same way about the ending as you did. It kind of started to fall apart for me when they built the apartment in the studio. But now that I think of it, it was based on true story. When do you get a climactic or satisfying ending in real life? And I don't mean that like that, you pervs. I saw Last House on the Left remake, but I can't remember anything of it. It's just meh, and that's absolutely the worst thing if you're dealing with that kind of subject matter. It's been even longer since I saw the original. I still remember being disgusted. Maybe the remake was just too well made and took the edge off the gritty style of the 70s. Somehow made everything feel more real. The same goes for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for example. The remake was okay, but you could almost smell the house and the horrors in the original, whereas the 2003 one felt like a popcorn movie. Ken Coakley, 3959. Blowout was a really good movie. It played at 4 screen drive-ins in 81 with Dress to Kill. My brother-in-law and sister watched that while I went to another screen to see Dawn of the Dead. De Palma is another director with an impressive filmography. Phantom of the Paradise is my favorite, but he did films that are remembered, such as Carrie, Scarface, The Untouchables, but others that were overlooked as such as The Fury, Body Doubles, Casualties of War, and Obsession. Yeah, De Palma's done a lot more movies than people give him credit for. I love Carrie, Scarface, Untouchables, all great, but The Fury's pretty good. I mean, Casualties of War is very memorable, and then, of course, you know, I mean, Phantom, you're right, Phantom of the Paradise is by far one of his best. I think Carrie's my favorite, but then Phantom of Paradise, then Blow Up, not sure which, but then Blowout. Speaking of great directors, William Friedkin recently passed away. Aside from The French Connection to The Exorcist, I also like Sorcerer as well as Cruisin' and To Live and Die in L.A. He also did a documentary about the late Father Gabriel Amor, who was the exorcist from Rome, Archdiocese, and he had some interesting projects that were never realized, such as The Devil's Triangle. which was going to be a UFO thriller starring Marlon Brando, Steve McQueen, and Charlton Heston. Sounds good. He was supposed to be doing an adaptation of The Executioner, which was a monthly book series about a man waging a one-man war against the mafia. It was originally set to star Sylvester Stallone and Cynthia Rothrock. That would have been awesome. Friedkin was supposed to do two William Peter Blatty books, including Legion, later made as Exorcist 3, and Demeter, about a priest executed in the atheist country, Albany. Albany, New York. Stoker Stab 1. The interview with the director of Chaos was hilarious. If I remember correctly, he does it in a morgue, but I didn't really care for Chaos or The Last House on the Left remake. I don't love The Entity either. I never found the ghost rape disturbing, only comical. Hudson 3838. Maybe a silly question, you decide, but if the original Last House on the Left never existed, would you have shown the remake more love? I know the remake wouldn't it have existed if not for the original, or would it? It's out of the UK this week, and it's out in the UK this week, and looking at the trailer, really tempted, which leads me to the next question. Have you seen the recent or old trailers that made you must-see that movie, but it turns out to be a big letdown? I mean, by the big size of Jupiter Big. As far as you're saying, like, if the original never existed? See, the problem with the Last House on the Left remake, it can't stand on its own. It's not a movie that stands on its own. So the question is just doesn't make any sense to me. Sorry. Now, if it's just like saying I don't know, like it just doesn't work in that kind of aspect. It's not one that the movie solely wants to have its cake and eat it too. It wants to be approachable by the mainstream, but get the impact of the original and live off the original, but not do what the original did. So I can't really say. Maybe if I didn't have the fondness for the original that I do, or the respect for the original, maybe I would respect it a little bit more. Like I said, it's a well-made movie. I just don't think doesn't have any guts. And I'm sorry. Like a movie like that, it needs guts. Or it becomes even more offensive in a way, right? If it doesn't fall through landing. So have I seen any recent trailers? I haven't watched many trailers lately, but what is a trailer that was really great? Surf Nazis Must Die has the best trailer ever, and the movie's just okay. There we go. Because I love that trailer. Zami Adams, a great episode. I love The Entity. They changed how they do shit now on YouTube, so when I copy it, it's like their names. It's not actually their names anymore, which I miss. Kentuckinator, good discussion on the nature of remakes in general. Vampire Jack 10, I actually quite like the remake of Last House on the Left, same as the remake of Ice Spin and Grape, both solid remakes. Yeah, more power to you, not my thing. Southport Rocker 4929, Blowout is one of my favorite movies. It's done very well, really enjoy the audio, sound side of it, and how Travolta's character pieces it together, not to mention the end scene. Cool update as well. Thank you. Hey, fella. Totally disagree about 2000's horror. I think it's maybe the only decade since the 70s to recapture some of the anything goes attitude. Yeah, the remake trend was obnoxious at the time, but I think a good amount of them are much better than they're given credit. I do think a lot of the remakes are better than they are given credit for. Like, I was giving credit to the Dawn remake, the Crazies remake. I don't even think, like, the Thing prequel is that bad. You know what I mean? There's ones that are pretty good. I don't hate the Texas Chainsaw remake. I don't hate the Halloween remake. So there's a lot of remakes I don't hate. I would say that they do have the anything goes attitude, stuff like Hostel and some of the Saw movies. But I do think that they're missing the impact that the 70s had. Now, maybe that could be a time and a place, no doubt. But also, they don't seem to have a message or a meaning. And now some people could say, well, not all 70s movies did, but even the exploitation movies that weren't trying somehow resonated or came across more transgressive. Maybe that's just you putting it on there because they're older and you're reflecting from a different time. See, I was very young at that time watching a lot of those movies, maybe a teenager, so you're a little bit more sour maybe to the experience, and that could be a problem that I have with a lot of movies from that time. There's no doubt. I mean, we all live different experiences and we don't see things all the same way, right? And he says 2010's horror by comparison was so much more safe and self-important. Either these wannabe dramas where the director's clearly ashamed to be working within a genre mode, or they're referential meta throwbacks that lack the bite or sincerity of the films they're referencing. The Last House on the Left remake isn't touching the original in terms of quality, but I think it's a complimentary film that also works on its own. How I feel about the Last House one. The 2010s, now, I do think that there is some movies that are like that. They just don't seem very sincere. They're just kind of like aping the original. Like Conjuring to me is one movie that feels like kids bought versions of the other movies it's referencing, like Amityville and Exorcist, and it's just very, very cookie cutter for the mainstream. Just a very toned down version of those other movies, which I don't think the Conjuring first movie is that good. Sorry, I think the sequel's better, and that's mostly just because of performances from the leads. Now, if you're talking about like are trying to shit on like Jordan Peele or Ari Aster, I would disagree. I don't think Ari Aster or Jordan Peele are ever ashamed of a horror movie. I think maybe the marketing team were, but I don't think they are. Now, I mean, maybe we all see things differently, you know. Maybe they have been overhyped and whatnot, or I mean. They may come across pretentious at times, but you know, it's all different kind of aspects. And like, I see what you're saying. Like, I do agree on some points with you and I disagree on others. I just think like the highs of the early 2000s were pretty high, but the lows were unbearable. So then we have Ken Coakley again. The original, is that the original Last House on the Left on 4K? I mean, yeah, no, I mean, I reviewed the movie. It says up in the top, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but it's like you, I have a special place for the original. I went all the way, went to an all-night horror marathon in 2006 with The Last House on the Left as the first film. Great. People were laughing at it for the first 20 minutes or so. People in front of me were also laughing, and I said, you won't laugh for long. And they laughed at me. When the movie was over, people were walking around in the daze. I saw a big guy crying. It's awesome. My brother saw it at the drive-in with Don't Look in the Basement and The House That Vanished. I was so jealous. Don't Look in the Basement's one I always heard played with it. My parents remember that one. And Last House on the Left, I think they might have saw. David Hess was the best villain actor. It's so hard to believe that he was a really cool guy. I couldn't imagine Martin Cove as Krug. No. Hess was also provided the killer soundtrack. Of course, wrote it. Amazing stuff. Fred Lincoln as Weasel reminded me of younger Robert Mitchum, and Jeremy Rayne was great as well. She went from looking like something out of the John Wilders movie to being beautiful when she stayed at the parents' house. Hess is amazing in the movie. Hands down. Martin Cove wouldn't have been right. Martin Cove can be scary, but not that kind of scary. Now on to Monsters Revenge. I met David Hess. I think a couple years before he died, he was really cool. Now on to Monsters Revenge. I'm a huge Monsters fan, and yes, I even like Rob Zombie's version. The film had sentimental value to me as it was one of the many movies I ordered from a video store where I worked at in 98. I ordered that, John Carpenter's Sting, Lucio Fulci Zombies, and a bunch more. I got them in October of 98. The Monsters Revenge, I got a kick out of the Phantom Opera character. Yeah, he was funny, right? He's just so, like, I just, like, can't help but laugh at him because he's so silly. There was another Monsters TV movie. It was directed by Robert Ginty, who starred in The Exterminator. Edward Herman from The Lost Boys played Herman. Another actor from The Exterminator, Irwin Keyes, was in the film as well. The booklet was Showgirls. Yeah, I figured it was Showgirls. It just must have got thrown in there because they forgot to put it in last time. But I was just confused. I think there was a misprint issue on the original booklet, but I was just like threw out of there. And I was like, I didn't. Showgirls was in the last box. So didn't know what the hell was going on. Yeah, Edward Herman is a perfect Herman monster, right? Looks just like him. I didn't see that new TV movie, but I used to watch The Monsters as a kid. I think I watched it more than The Addams Family, but I was more familiar with the Addams Family movies, if that makes any sense, than the Monsters TV movies. But so we're going to get out of here, guys. I think that we covered everything. I hope you guys enjoyed it. All right, guys, thank you very much for watching. And as always, have a good one.